Welcome back to part three of Broad Appeal's Good, Bad, Crazy Glenda Jackson edition. I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian.
And we're ready for the crazy part.
We are. We've done something, Sean, just now that is hardly crazy. It's actually purely sensible based on our own economic self-interest.
We voted.
By the time that you listen to this, perhaps it's old news, whatever the results of the local council elections in Lambeth were, but between recording part two and part three, we did stroll briskly down the street to put our crosses on the ballot papers. And Sean, I know you never reveal your vote, but is it fair to say that you were wearing a red t-shirt and Glenda was probably happy with your choice?
Yes, I'm wearing a red one. It's true, I am.
So Glenda can be very serious. She can be very political. She can be very feminist. She can also be utter and completely camp.
Yes. A camp quality that David Hoyle aspires to.
The film that we're going to talk about now, Salome's Last Dance, directed by Ken Russell, may well earn the title of the most obscure film that we have ever covered on Broad Appeal.
What about
Notting Hill?
No. What was that with Whoopi Goldberg?
I don't know. The Associate, I think, in its day, was certainly popular and probably marketed quite a lot.
Theodore Rex.
Yeah, they tried to bury Theodore Rex. But let's be honest, Salome's Last Dance is an obscure oddity. It defines cult film. It is both weird and queer and a literary adaptation.
And interesting and kind of boring.
And also kind of amazing.
And also kind of stagey, but also kind of cinematically theatrical.
Yeah, it's essentially the type of movie that Good, Bad, Crazy as a format was designed for, and I'm very, very glad that we've finally seen it.
Yeah, me too.
You have wanted to watch Salome's Last Dance for a long time. I suspect probably on our, like, third date, you're like, let me show you this thing on YouTube. You know, you have been...
Some things never change.
Yeah, you have been a one-man trumpet band for Salome's Last Dance, even though you'd never seen it.
No, I'd never seen it. I wanted to see it for years. I've seen... I went through a phase of being really into Ken Russell films. But, you know, here's the thing, is that when I really like someone, I really kind of eke out their filmography, because I kind of don't want to, you know, blow my load so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, so, like, I'm a big fan of Douglas Sirk, but there's loads of ones that I haven't seen yet that I will get around to. And for Ken Russell, you know, I haven't seen Tommy or Listomania or Altered States.
The Boyfriend?
I haven't seen The Boyfriend, but I have seen things like Whore and Lair of the White Worm.
You've seen Lair of the White Worm?
I have, and Whore.
You just like saying that.
No, Whore was NC-17, and they couldn't advertise the name of the film because it was called Whore. So it was also called If You Can't Say It, Just See It.
That's a great tagline.
Yeah.
So Sean, as the resident Ken Russell aficionado in the room, there's only two people in the room.
Yes.
But there's many people listening. Explain to us Ken Russell's status in British cinema, and also, if you can, how he became so closely associated with someone who, in many other ways, is a quite highbrow actress, right? Glenda is known for her Shakespeare, for her literary adaptations, for playing Elizabeth I, and she's also known for being in these crazy, breast-bearing sex fests that Ken Russell concocted. How on earth did this come to be?
Well, I'm no expert, I have to admit, but, you know, Ken Russell began working in the 1960s. He was kind of like an enfant terrible of British cinema. He was very artistic. He had his own particular sensibilities. Apparently he's obsessed with Catholicism as well.
Mm, the devils, right?
Yeah. Even, I'm not quite sure if he was a Catholic, but he was obsessed with it.
It's probably the high theatricality of it that he loves.
Yeah. And, you know, he was kind of a perverse filmmaker in the truest sense of the word. Like, he had a perverse view of the world, which is why I think he was a great choice to take Women in Love and then kind of toy with it a little bit.
I think what I find fascinating about Ken Russell, the bits of his work that I've seen, is that he clearly has an interest in different periods of history and particularly different artists from history and literature. D.H. Lawrence, Tchaikovsky, like that's what The Music Lovers is about, Tchaikovsky, right? In this film, Oscar Wilde. But he has no reverence for them, right? Like, the critique of things like Merchant Ivory when they do a film like Surviving Picasso or whatever is that they approach all their subjects with this kind of staid reverence. Whereas Ken Russell, it feels like what he's trying to do is bring a very anarchic, contemporary vibe, even if it's a period piece. I mean, even something like Women in Love. Women in Love feels to me like a subversive literary adaptation that just about passes as being like a masterpiece theater type of thing, but actually if you look beneath the cracks in the surface, it actually nearly borders on camp as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. So he takes kind of classic books, classic figures, classic plays, and then just like...
wraps them up.
Yeah, puts them through the blender of his own crazy, perverse imagination.
Yeah.
And by the time he got around to doing Salome's Last Dance, you know, he was nowhere near the mainstream of filmmaking, right?
No, he was much older. He was a real boozer, you know, kind of a bit out of touch. You know, he'd kind of worked his way into his own sensibilities of things.
And correct me if I'm wrong on this, but Ken Russell was not gay.
No, he was not gay.
So this is basically the gayest filmography, or maybe even we could say the queerest.
It is queer, yeah.
Queerest, campest.
Truly queer.
Of anyone who is basically just straight, as far as I can tell.
You know, if we're thinking of queer in the most academic terms, and I just mentioned the word perverse, you know, that is kind of what loops them all together, is this way of viewing the world not through the eyes of which, you know, polite society chooses to see what is comical, what is gross, what is vile and disgusting, but also what is kind of heady about it the entire time.
And this is about taking all the rules of polite society and not just breaking them, but like exploding them.
Absolutely.
It's amazing that this film, Salome's Last Dance, it starts off quite boringly but ends quite shockingly. This is all before Glenda's run as a member of parliament, yes?
Yes. This is one of her last films.
It's amazing to me that, you know, as you said, people tried to use her filmography against her in those early campaigns, because you could totally imagine if she was running in, like, Alabama or somewhere, you know, they're like, we're fine with a pedophile, but a woman who bares her breasts in a brothel, wearing vermilion eyeshadow, talking to Oscar Wilde, like, that is too much for us.
She didn't bear her breasts in this, did she?
I guess, no, she didn't, but she's bared her breasts plenty of times.
Plenty of times.
And there are plenty of bared breasts in this film, as well as openly exposed genitalia of both sexes.
Yes, just for a moment, but it's a good moment.
Okay, now we're going to switch over to my area of expertise, which is the theatre.
Go for it, darling.
The theatre. Okay, the basic premise of Salome's Last Dance, there's like a frame story, which actually features Oscar Wilde himself. So this is essentially Ken Russell's version of Oscar Wilde's last play, Salome, which was banned by the Lord Chamberlain, presumably for its heresy, its sexual explicitness, and it was only ever premiered in France in a French translation, because, as we all know, those French, any of those doors marked French, they're much more comfortable with the erotic, yeah?
Erotique.
Yeah, it premiered in France. We'd have to consult a wildologist for the exact chronology, but it was around the same time that he was getting into scrapes with Lord Alfred Douglas, Bosie, that eventually led to his trial and imprisonment for gross indecency. So Oscar Wilde, from having been the toast of the town, became a kind of persona non grata, had his life thoroughly destroyed.
Yeah, it's really sad, you know?
And while most of Wilde's plays have this veneer of kind of drawing room comedy, right? And even though they have subversive undertones and witty lines, Salome is a strange, experimental, kind of symbolist poetic play. It's also a play that you yourself have some history with, darling. I think we've never done a film on Broad Appeal in which you have actually delivered some of the dialogue yourself live on stage in the buff.
Yes, it's true. The first time I ever did Naked Boys Reading in London, it was curated by my now friend, our friend, Neil Bartlett.
Who is a renowned Oscar Wilde expert.
Yes, and he curated a series of texts for Naked Boys Reading asking for it, which was by far one of the horniest Naked Boys readings I've ever been to. At least it was on the dance floor after it was all over.
Mm.
You're telling me. Yeah, this is before we had to put our pants on after it was all over. I got me with the days, those halcyon days. But
my salad days when I was green in love.
Is that Lady Macbeth?
No, it's Cleopatra, but I've messed up the quote. That's really shocking. But you know, Glenda played Cleopatra.
Oh, I can believe it. Yes, I can believe it.
My salad days when I was green in judgment.
Very good. Now back to My Naked Body, please.
Okay, okay.
I chose to read an extended piece of Salome in which she is trying to seduce John the Baptist and he is denying her, and she says things like, "Your hair are like rich vines that hang in the garden of blah," and then when he refuses her, she's like, "Your hair is disgusting, your hair is like a brood of vipers," you know, of course I'm paraphrasing terribly here.
John the Baptist.
Who speaks?
Let me kiss your mouth.
Your performance was acclaimed, particularly for your breath control and your rhythm.
Yes, you helped me.
Yes, like all great performers, there's an acting coach behind it. I was Lee Strasberg to his Marilyn.
I prefer to think of you as my Beatrice Straight. To whoever it was you taught.
Everyone and anyone. Let it be known, if people don't know what Naked Boys Reading is, please follow at Naked Boys Read on Twitter. There's constant performances. Sort of every fourth or fifth time, you're bound to see me or Sean.
No, I've retired.
Oh, you've retired, darling.
Yes, I've retired.
Well, I'm like Norma Desmond. I'm always ready for my comeback.
I only curate now. I keep my clothes on because, you know, I have to be paid quite a lot of money to expose myself.
Well, so all of that brings us around to Saint Oscar, the patron saint of all homosexuals, and this film. The premise of Ken Russell's Salome's Last Dance is that the premiere of Oscar Wilde's controversial play, Salome, takes place in a brothel in 1892. So we see a little bit of kind of framing story as Oscar and Bosie walk into this brothel, which basically, the brothel just looks like a nice house in Mayfair, yeah?
Yeah.
And they walk in and they exchange sort of subpar Wildean lines like,
"The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about."
And things like, "Don't preach at me, I'm really not in the mood for the missionary position just now."
Yeah, it's a bit...
It's a bit stale.
It's a bit stale, yeah.
It's a bit stale, and the people playing Bosie and Oscar Wilde aren't particularly scintillating.
No,
yeah?
Bosie is not fit, and Oscar Wilde does not really look Wildean.
They say that sex is the theatre of the poor. You're not going to stage the beggar's opera, are you?
Stage? Yes, we have built a stage.
Ah.
You're getting hot.
Uh-huh.
You're almost there. Can't you guess?
I only play guessing games when I want to be beastly to my darling children. Oh, God.
And it all seems kind of flat, and I could sense from you, Sean.
I had a feeling of regret.
You had a feeling of regret. You almost actually stopped the film and thought, should we even be carrying on to the end of this?
Yeah, I was very hesitant.
It's pretty stale.
Because I thought it wasn't going to be crazy, it was going to be boring.
Yeah. Then, basically, the brothel keeper tells Oscar that he and the staff in the brothel, his employees, have decided to stage the premiere of Salome in a private audience for Oscar. And the majority of the film is actually, I think, a pretty close rendering of the text of the play of Salome,
mm-hmm.
presented on a stage for Oscar, who sits on a sofa with a kind of tiger skin rug displayed in front of him. So you'll be seeing a kind of mocked up, amateurish, theatrical version of the play with cutaways to Oscar, like, sniffing a green carnation and, like, stroking the nipples of a nubile boy, like, painted in gold and things like that. And then we get a little bit of frame story at the end. But most of it is basically just Ken Russell's weird fever dream of what a kind of manic camp performance of Salome would be.
Yes, and it ramps up as the film progresses.
It really does ramp up, and it really is ultimately, in the end, worth the investment. I would say anyone who enjoys things like Jack Smith, Kenneth Anger, all those kind of, like, queer filmmakers who are about excess and decadence and not making sense.
And have a punky sensibility.
Yeah.
Because actually, you know, when you mentioned earlier about Ken Russell's, you know, filmography, he also did Tommy, of course, which was this huge rock opera musical.
Yeah.
Like, he was really cool at one point.
Yeah, and in a weird way, this film is, like, beyond cool, because it's taking, like, an old text. There are moments that really reminded me in this of, like, even, like, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, you know? Like, when John the Baptist finally comes out, spoiler alert, the actor who had been playing Bosie is done up as John the Baptist, and he comes out with this kind of crazy wig and this pale makeup, and I said, it's Dr. Frank N. Furter. Like, he looks kind of like this androgynous creature. There are, like, statuesque Amazonian guards with huge pendulous bare breasts holding black spears that look completely like dildos, and they just whack him with them. Like, it's full
for
of...
For a good 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's full of really odd moments like that. Can we just describe the basic plot of Salome for anyone who has not read the Bible?
Well, actually, you know, I was saying to you, I was like, is this in the Bible? It's not really in the Bible, is it?
It is indeed in the Bible, Sean.
But it's not really... Like, the way it's told here is not in the Bible.
Well, no. The dildos are not in the Bible. Okay, so who was John the Baptist, Sean?
So John the Baptist was Jesus' cousin.
Yes.
Son of Elizabeth.
Well, historically, was he really Jesus' cousin? I don't know. I always feel that anything to do with Jesus' childhood and parentage is probably, like, fairy tales that were, like, made up to embroider the Gospels together. Because let's be honest, like, the earliest historical Gospel, which is Mark's, is the shortest one, and it's mostly just the things Jesus did and said. And then all the stuff about, you know, like, the virgin birth and, you know, Mary and Elizabeth.
Does John do this?
Yeah, all that stuff. Like, it's not... I think, actually, Luke is the one who kind of first brings all that in. Sorry, I'm bringing in my biblical scholarship here.
But Luke was a doctor, so I tend to trust him.
The Gospel of Luke is, like, quite a ways away from the life of the historical Jesus, and it was also... Luke was the apostle to the Gentiles.
Yeah.
So I think most biblical scholars tend to discount...
He was Greek, wasn't he?
Yeah, some of the other things from the later Gospels for their historical accuracy. But anyway, John the Baptist was a previous prophet. Whether he was Jesus' cousin, who knows? He went around baptizing people. He baptizes Jesus, and then he sees, no, this is the real Son of Man. And he goes about preaching that, yes, I am a prophet, but someone is going to come after me who's even greater than me, who's unfit to, you know, kiss my sandals, or whatever that line is.
Okay, can I check something with you here? Okay.
Kiss my sandals.
So, basically, you know when Mary goes to see Elizabeth, and Elizabeth reveals that she's pregnant, okay? Does this mean that John is only 9 months older than Jesus?
This is the thing. This is
so
what
how
I'm
did
saying.
He become like a radical preacher much sooner than Jesus?
This is
did?
What I'm saying. Like, none of this makes a lot of sense. And I think probably there is some historical basis for a prophet named John. There's historical basis for a prophet slash political leader named Jesus of Nazareth. And the linking of these two people together as like cousins... I'm sorry if the Pope wants to excommunicate me and ban me for this, but I'm sure there's some Jesuits around who would back me up. Like, that's the embroidery, right? Mm-hmm. That's the kind of fairy story that's kind of linking all this stuff.
Okay.
I'm being really heretical.
No, this
here.
Is great.
Okay. So the bit of the Gospel that we're talking about, John is going around saying, you know, repent, repent, the dawn of the Son of Man is coming. King Herod is on the throne. Now, Herod is installed by the Romans, because as you know, during this time, under the Roman Empire, the Jews, they were colonized, right, by Rome. So they didn't have power over their own society. These kings were imposed by Rome.
Don't fact check here, okay?
Yeah.
So when Jesus was born, Herod was on the throne. Is
that
it the same?
The earlier Herod.
Okay.
No. So it's the earlier Herod. And in fact, I think the Herod who's around with John the Baptist may be that Herod's brother or something. Because what the great crime that John the Baptist is complaining about is that the Herod who's now on the throne has actually married his brother's wife, Herodias.
Yeah, it's Herodias,
and
yeah.
And has this daughter, Salome. So there's this whole sense of decadence and incest.
Yeah, because Herod is into Salome.
Who's his stepdaughter.
Yeah.
So basically, it's a Woody Allen, Mia Farrow situation.
Of course, I get it.
Salome is Sunyi.
Yeah.
There we
Sunyi's
go.
Sunyi's last dance.
We shouldn't... Okay, we shouldn't joke about that. But anyway, so what
happened... Oh, no, but actually, he's technically her niece. He is her uncle, because... So it is incest.
Yeah, and he's kind of longing and lusting for Salome, and in trying to please Salome, he says to her, I will give you anything that you want. And what does she request?
Well, she requests John the Baptist's head on a plate.
Right. So John the Baptist is beheaded. That head is given to Salome. So all of that is in the gospel. I think it's probably the gospel of Luke. Someone can fact check this for me. But it's a few paragraphs, which kind of brings an end to John the Baptist's narrative in the gospels. And then we get, you know, Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. Oscar Wilde has clearly taken those outlines of the story and he's kind of stretched it out and he's added poetry, right? It's not the most complicated plot. But here's my question to you, Sean. Why is this story of interest to Oscar Wilde?
I mean, I'm guessing the themes are a bit salacious and controversial and we get people talking about things. I don't know. Is that
it? I mean, it's about desire, right? There's this kind of transposed desire that actually Salome longs for John the Baptist. She can't have him because he's pure and he, like, has pledged his body and his soul to God, and he's preaching about, you know, the coming of the Son of Man. But her desire is so strong that she then wants to destroy him, destroy what she can't mm-hmm. have, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So in this same kind of decadent way that other fin de siècle writers and artists are kind of fascinated by decadence and the breaking of boundaries, I think Oscar Wilde is really fascinated about this kind of merging of the sacred and the profane. I guess the story of Herod is in the gospel to show, look at these profane old people in the previous regime who couldn't understand, like, the dawning of a new age of morality. They killed John the Baptist, but they'll all, you know, be sent to hell and destroyed for their incestuous crimes. Oscar Wilde is kind of seducing us into understanding that sense of decadence and desire and sort of luxuriating in it, all the blood and all the killing. He's really eroticizing death, right? Like, there's famous images drawn by Aubrey Beardsley of Salome holding the severed head of John the Baptist and, like, longingly looking at it and, like, parting her lips and wanting to kiss it. So you can see why Oscar Wilde is into this, and you can also see where Ken Russell drew all his inspiration. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Who does Glenda Jackson play?
She plays Herodias.
Yeah,
and she's the wife of Herod. So interestingly, because she's female, I guess that's why, and she's of Herod, that she's just called Herodias or something.
Yeah, who knows? So we get all this set up, the stage play starts. The role of Salome is actually being played by a little chambermaid mm-hmm. who we've seen earlier introduced. And I think Oscar says something to her like, what's that fragrance that you have on? And the brothel keeper says, it's ground up green carnations mixed with the pubic hair of virgins.
Yes.
That was the first indication we had that maybe this movie was going to have something going for it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's describe the cast of characters. There's Salome, who's essentially a little Lolita-like tart.
She's skivvy.
But she's done up in this kind of glamorous way. She has this kind of belt I can only describe as it has a dangly, bejeweled...
It's like a chainmail fringe.
Yeah, it has a dangly, bejeweled sort of fascinator kind of thing that calls attention to her nether regions.
Mm-hmm.
And I roll my R's very deliberately because Glenda seems to roll every R in this in this performance. Erotic. Yes. So that's what Salome looks like.
Mm-hmm. The brothel keeper himself plays Herod.
Yeah, and he's this kind of, like, doughy, pudgy, you know, oversexed guy.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed the casting of the two guards in the play.
So the two Roman guards, so you got one, like, pale, fat guy.
And with you got kind of sagging nipples.
And a big beer belly.
Yeah.
And you've got one really buff, tanned,
like
oiled
Charles
up.
Atlas type.
Like, yeah. Charles Atlas on steroids.
Yeah. And they are kind of this double act of, like, the pudgy one and the buff one. There's some kind of other young Roman guy who is kind of blonde and wispy, who is in love with Salome at the start. And then he also has someone who's besotted with him, who is this boy twink, who kind of lisps and talks like this, and is painted entirely in gold.
Yeah, entirely in gold.
Have I ever told you about in Oliver Stone's JFK, how Kevin Bacon appears in a decadent party in New Orleans painted entirely in gold?
You've mentioned, yeah.
So whenever I see people painted in gold, I think of Kevin Bacon.
You don't think of Goldfinger, no?
And Goldfinger, no. Anyway, so, okay, basically, that's the setup of all this stuff. We see Salome, like, trying to seduce John the Baptist. He's down a well, all this kind of stuff. Do you want to just highlight any particularly striking moments or images from the film before we get to analyzing Glenda's performance? Because she really doesn't come into it for about a third of the movie.
Yeah, you're really longing for her to come. Well, it has this beautiful artificial quality to it. There's this moon that appears on the stage that's like behind a set, which is behind another set, which kind of frames the whole thing.
Blood red moon at times.
Yeah, John the Baptist is kept in a dungeon.
Lots of dry ice billowing.
Yeah, but it's actually just a dumbwaiter. It regularly goes from the stage to the audience where Oscar Wilde is lying on the aforementioned tiger skin rug.
Mm-hmm.
And Ken Russell himself appears as a photographer. And by photographer, I mean the ones where he has to like put his head under a sheet, you know?
Yeah, those
everyone
old
has to
school
stay
ones.
Deathly still.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's that thing, the flash. I love those old things.
Yeah, they're great. So Salome is drawn to the well. She's drawn to John the Baptist. Herod and Herodias are off having a banquet, and we don't hear much of Glenda except for her to shout from the wings and say things like, "Come back to the banquet. Do not look at her. I do not want you to look at her.
Don't look at her. Look at her."
Because Herod is obsessed with his stepdaughter. His stepdaughter is obsessed with John the Baptist. Everyone's basically gazing at the people they shouldn't be gazing at, and they're motivated by desire.
Yeah, we should also say that John the Baptist is partially in prison because he has said dreadful things about Herodias herself.
Yeah, for being incestuous.
Yes.
He has said horrible things about me. He is screeching like a bird.
Bird of prey.
So Sean really perked up and got interested when finally this little tart Salome started delivering the very monologue that you yourself had delivered on the stage of the Ace Hotel.
Yeah, I was like, I know this.
Oh my god, that sounds really familiar. But actually, that scene was also where I think Ken Russell's filmmaking really perked up, because there's some quite transgressive bits. Like, it's been rather stagey and rather camp and amateurish and silly, but then we get John and Salome in tight close-up. You know, she's saying, "There's nothing so white as your body." And then he spits at her.
Oh yeah, oh my god. That? There's a few aspects to this monologue where she says, "Your hair is beautiful, your body is beautiful, and lastly, your mouth is beautiful, you know, and disgusting as well." And she says, "I will kiss your mouth." And then he spits on her face.
And we really see the, like, glob of saliva, like, yeah, hit this young actress.
Yeah. And then, as it's trickling down her face, she licks her lips and, like, sucks it in.
I mean, like, I haven't seen that sort of thing in anything that wasn't a Treasure Island media film.
And it wasn't spit we were talking about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But she licks it lusciously. And then he still won't give up his body to her.
Mm-hmm.
He's chained, and then those, like, Amazonian warriors, like, whack him and give him lashes, and we see a shot of his back with the, like, bright red lashes, mm-hmm, that he's been kind of put through torture because he won't give his body over to Salome. And this is where the movie kind of ramps up the camp, okay?
Ramps the camp.
Yeah, ramping the camp. So he gets tossed back down the well. Herod is trying to get Salome to pay attention to him. And Herodias is coming out. Like, Glenda does not have a major role in this in terms of plot. But what's fascinating is, like, all the other people in this movie are not very well known, right?
Mm-hmm.
Glenda is a 2-time Academy Award winner who is here as the Grande Dame. Mm-hmm. Do you want to just describe, Sean, how she looks as Herodias?
Okay, so her face is painted white, her lips are painted bright red, and she has this eyeshadow that starts at the bottom of the eye and goes all the way up to the eyebrow, which is crimson, practically, as well as a smoky eye, and this big bejeweled crown that also has tassels that hang down on the side of her face, and she's in, you know, bejeweled robes and clasps, and, you know, it's basically everything, you know what I mean? And she looks like David Hoyle, you know?
Yeah, she also looks a bit like Norma Desmond, or, like, I don't know who. She just looks like every kind of crazy grande dame ever. And
yeah,
she doesn't really have much to do other than to sit on the side, and, like, every time that Herod and Salome want to do something, she just kind of languidly barks at them and says, "My daughter, do not dance. Mm-hmm. Do not look at her. Yeah. I'm so tired of all the dreadful things he's saying.
I don't want her to dance.
Oh, I don't believe in prophets. How can anyone say what will happen? No one knows.
You are always looking at her. Don't look at her.
Shut them up!
And she sits there smoking.
Well, she also does a lot of other things. So she winking. Kind of, she picks her teeth. Mm-hmm. She picks her teeth by staring at her reflection in a golden plate. She also plays a very memorable game of chess where the chess pieces are.
Marshmallows.
Which as soon as she gets the pieces, she stuffs the marshmallows in her mouth. She kind of leers suggestively at the hunky, fit guard. And then when she's a bit sick of the things that Salome and Herod are doing, she climbs with the guard into a trunk, presumably to shtup him. So Glenda is giving us pure comedy. She's a real comedy queen in this one. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
she could win the Snatch Game hands down.
I could see Bianca Del Rio in this role.
Has anyone ever done Glenda Jackson on the Snatch Game?
No, Brian. They have not.
Would that be your choice if you went on to RuPaul?
It would be one of those things, right? Like Jinx Monsoon explaining to them all who I am.
So Glenda gets in this trunk. She's gone for a while. And then Salome decides to do the Dance of the Seven Veils, okay?
Well, why does she decide to do it?
Well, she's kind of coaxed into it by Herod. Herod is like, if you dance for me, I'll give you anything that you want, yeah? Because he basically is smitten with his stepdaughter / niece. The Dance of the Seven Veils is pretty much the set piece scene of this film. Now, you have some inside information, don't you, Sean, about how this was filmed and some of the peculiarities of it?
Yes, Brian, and that's because you and I had Christmas dinner with the editor of this film.
That is true. We had met this man before socially. We knew he was a film editor, but we had no idea that he'd been the editor for Salome's Last Dance. Sean really perked up over the Christmas pudding when that information came out.
Yeah.
And you kind of extracted as many anecdotes as you could about this.
Well, he said that, you know, they shot it in a few weeks, and Glenda was kind of there to keep Ken under wraps.
Because Ken was drinking.
He was drinking a lot, yeah.
Okay.
As time went on, he was very good in the beginning, but by the time it finished, he was, you know, stoicious for the second half of the day.
And the young girl who plays Salome, I mean, she seems really young. I mean, almost uncomfortably young, because the whole thing is about kind of incest from a stepfather to daughter, and she really seems like a teenager.
Yeah,
like
she does, for sure.
It's not like Sue Lyon in Lolita, where she seems matronly and she's meant to be 16,
yeah.
You know?
The sad thing about it, though, is that this girl in question, she went blind shortly before the filming started.
Like, completely blind?
Like, near blind.
That's fascinating.
Like, she couldn't read the script. She had to learn it by, like, walking on a treadmill with headphones on. Pretty appalling, really, the poor woman.
And so when it comes to doing the Dance of the Seven Veils, of course, she has this veil over her face. Very, very Valentina, right? We can't see that it's really her with the face. So it becomes clear as the dance goes on that in the shots where the dancing is happening, that it's not the same actress. Now, do you think that was a deliberate aesthetic choice, or was this something to cover up the fact that this young woman had lost her eyesight?
I would say it began as that, but as we know by the conclusion of the dance, there was a very conscious decision to include something.
Yes, so as the shots carry on, we knew, because we'd got the gossip from the aforementioned editor,
yeah,
that this was not indeed the same actress dancing. It was not indeed a female dancing. That is a male dancer.
Very fit, I have to say.
Yeah, you know, with that kind of lean, balletic body.
Great butt.
When you say great butt, there's a shot where his butt cheeks basically take up the entire screen with a G-string right through the crack. And you can definitely see in a lot of the shots that it is a male back, and it is,
oh,
it
yes.
is a male physiognomy. So he'll be spinning around and dancing, and then there'll be intercut a shot of like her face like winking, and then back to him. So it's all very artificial and very, very fake. You know, Oscar Wilde and Herod are like completely enraptured by this whole thing.
And what music is playing?
I think it's Rimsky-Korsakov. It's whatever music goes. Actually, no, wait, I take that back. Isn't that the Hall of the Mountain King by Edvard Grieg?
Oh, I thought it might be, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, some people are dropping their biscuits in their tea thinking, I thought these two were cultured. We'll just leave that out there for the audience to determine. Whatever that song is that goes dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, it's definitely Hall of the Mountain King.
Okay.
So that's what's playing. She's dancing the Seven Veils, and then there is a big ol' reveal at the end.
Yeah.
I guess the idea of the Dance of Seven Veils is by the time the seventh veil is unveiled, you see it all,
yeah.
Right? It's like the money shot. It's like Gypsy Rose Lee, yeah?
Yeah.
You gotta get a gimmick.
Yeah, and actually, it's done very well, because the loincloth, as it were, is pulled off.
Mm-hmm.
Ken Russell is there as the photographer, making the flash happen, the light, the light. So it is in a flash. You get to see the bushy junk of this young male. Okay, with his.
So I mean, yeah. If people haven't been observant so far, and unlike us, haven't picked up on the fact that it's clearly a man dancing, suddenly you see
his dick,
a penis.
Yeah.
And then what happens?
And then there's a flash of the camera, and then it's just Muff.
Yeah, it literally changes from a penis to a vagina.
Which I think is just brilliant.
Yeah, no,
I think it's hilarious. I think it's wonderful.
It's amazing. And you can totally understand why the Conservative Party of Hampstead and Highgate thought, the person who's appeared in this film is going to represent us at the Palace of Westminster? I think not.
I say no, no, no.
The lady's not for turning.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Very good, Ryan.
Thank you. Sink the Belgrano.
Do it. Dennis, sink the Belgrano.
We've done that impersonation more than any other one in this podcast. Okay, so that is clearly the aesthetic and sexual highlight of the film. Having danced the Dance of the Seven Veils, of course, Salome wants the head of John the Baptist on a plate. Then they bring out an executioner. Actually, we haven't talked about some of the more politically incorrect and problematic aspects of this film.
Are there any?
Yeah. So the executioner is a oiled and muscled, enormous bodybuilding...
Black guy. Only person of color in the film.
He has no lines.
Yeah.
And he comes out with an enormous kind of axe. To kind of go and cut off John the Baptist's head. There's also three little people who are dressed in the kind of traditional garb of Hasidic Jews, and they're kind of like thrown around like toys, and at different points, courtesans like
sit on their faces
and put heads between their thighs, and Glenda says things like, "Give him to the Jews." With all the issues going on in the Labour Party right now, I don't think anybody wants to have copies of Salome's Last Dance like going around, because it does frankly seem a little bit anti-Semitic.
Well, this is the thing about Ken Russell, is that I think he was so into Catholicism that everything else was the antithesis of it. If you see Lair of the White Worm, there's this amazing scene where Amanda Donoghue sees a crucifix and then like vomits all over it.
Wow. Okay, so those are all some of the problematic parts. The aforementioned executioner goes down the well, cuts off John the Baptist's head, and Glenda says things like, "Why is he not screaming? There should be screaming." At one point, she also says, like, completely randomly, she says the line, "A handbag," which of course is a reference to the importance of being earnest. And it led us to wonder, has Glenda Jackson ever played Lady Bracknell? And if not, can we, like, get her on stage doing that as quickly as possible?
Isn't she a bit old to play Lady Bracknell?
I feel like Lady Bracknell is timeless, and she just kind of, like, literally Lady Bracknell is, like, the perfect role for Glenda Jackson, because all she'd have to do is, like, walk in, sit center stage, and just deliver bon mot, you know?
Yeah. What about Emma Stone as Lady Bracknell? Jennifer Lawrence, perhaps.
Yeah, Jennifer Lawrence would be perfect. Okay. Then they wheel up the severed head of John the Baptist, which is on a plate. Presumably it's some kind of plastic or paper mache thing.
But this is the kind of the spooky bit, is that, you know, we were told that he's just in a box underneath the stage, but there's a moment where the plate is lifted off and carried over, and we see Oscar Wilde sitting there being like,
"Have they killed my beloved Bosie?"
Yeah.
And the little actress who plays Salome, she's now wearing a completely different dress, which is essentially just like a drape.
I love that. I've done that so many times
at home.
It
goes up her complete side of her body.
Yeah. I love doing that with the towel.
Yeah. Yeah. Whenever Sean goes anywhere near a long piece of fabric, he takes off all his clothes and drapes it around it and says things like, "Take a picture of me, take a picture of me." We're getting very confessional in this episode. Okay, so... Anyway,
I've never met a piece of tulle that I didn't like.
All right. So she dances around and kisses the severed head. And I mean, clearly this is the bit that really upset the Lord Chamberlain in the original play of Salome.
Okay, so the film concludes with, you know, with John the Baptist's head on a plate, but Herodias does get the last laugh.
Well, she orders someone to throw a spear and kill the girl.
Yeah, so we see this very big buff soldier throwing his spear across the stage, landing squarely in her back, and she falls to the ground.
And again, it's this kind of mix-up of, like, has this been a real act of violence or theatrical act of violence?
Yeah.
Then everyone applauds, the play is over, the curtain comes down. Oscar Wilde says, is there not going to be a curtain call? And the brothel keeper says, no, everyone's getting out of their drag. And slowly, the kind of all the people emerge. They're the, you know, denizens of this brothel. Glenda is not actually a lady of the night. She's some kind of aristocratic actress lady named Lady Alice, who's just come from the palace, who is slumming it in the brothel. They all exchange pleasantries with the Oscar Wilde character, and everybody's like a bit like, where's the girl who's playing Salome? Mm-hmm. And we're meant to think that she's actually been killed.
Yes, and then the police raid the home.
Well, it's not a home, it's a brothel.
Well, it's someone's home.
Well, the police raid the brothel to kind of shut it down, and they take the brothel keeper, Lady Alice slash Glenda, and Oscar Wilde into the paddy wagon. Now, the implication is that Oscar Wilde has actually been ratted out by Bosie, because Bosie's nowhere to be seen.
Treacherous.
And he was treacherous in real life, of course. And he's been jealous that Oscar was having hanky-panky with the aforementioned gold-painted boy. And they put Oscar into the paddy wagon and they say something like, we're bringing you in on charges of gross indecency and corrupting minors, which actually was the charges that Oscar was brought in on. Everyone seems remarkably cheery. They look at Glenda, and when they realize that she's a woman called Lady Alice, they say something like, we took you for a whore, miss. It kind of ends with kind of a final shot of the three of them in the police van being taken off to jail, and they talk about the death of the girl, and Glenda says, murder? It was death by misadventure. She slipped on a banana peel. Mm-hmm. And that's basically the end of the movie.
It is.
This is a weird movie. In some ways, I think the irreverence of the film does seem fitting to Oscar Wilde. Like, you kind of feel like if Oscar had lived until 1980 whatever, when this film came out, that he kind of would have enjoyed this milk.
It's reverently irreverent. No, try that again. It's reverently irreverent. Yeah, say again.
I just called it a milm, and you just said it's reverently irrelevant.
Okay, now you try that again.
But I think we're both correct. This milm is completely irrelevant.
Milm? You didn't say a film.
I did. I was about to say we should record that again, but I said milm. The lair of the white milm.
Yeah, let me try that again. Reverently irreverent.
With a touch of glass.
There we are.
Yeah. Would you tell people to find, somehow, Salome's Last Dance?
Well, you know, it used to be on Netflix.
And is it not anymore?
Nope.
Okay, Netflix, if you're listening, bring it back.
Yeah.
There's an audience of at least three people who are our super fans who will seek it out, and you know who you are.
You know who you are, darlings.
But honestly, I feel like there's a wonderful subset of movies, which I like to think of as movies that you put on silently at some kind of gay dinner party and or orgy. And Salome's Last Dance would kind of be perfect.
Agreed.
It's the one that you kind of want to see visually with, like, Glenda and her vermilion eyeshadow, but you kind of don't need to hear it all. Like, you could have, you know, your Madonna and your Kacey Musgraves, you know, whatever kind of music you like is playing while you look at Glenda, like, licking her lips and kind of being whacked by dildos.
So, it's a recommendation.
To Horny Thumbs Way Up. That brings us to the end of Glenda Jackson, MP, Grand Dame, ageless, completely relevant, and back on our stages and our screens. Will Glenda ever die?
Yes, she will.
I don't know. She's smoked a lot. She's clearly got bone density issues, but she's still around. She's still thriving.
Eight shows a week, baby.
I think she might outlast Olivia de Havilland. We might still have 20 more years of Glenda.
No, we won't.
You don't think so?
No, I give it 8 years max.
This is really terrible that we're speculating about her demise. But in the time that she has left, is there any role that you would love to see her play?
I'd love to see her play, like, a panto dame.
Mmm.
Oh, no, remember I told you. No, I want to see her play Dr. Van Helsing.
Yes, of course, in Sean's famous Royal Vauxhall Tavern version of Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yeah.
She and David Hoyle could alternate the roles, you know.
Yeah, to different nights.
Yeah, on different nights to allow Glenda to rest a bit.
Yeah.
I think this, we've talked about this enough that it has to happen.
Yeah.
Okay, we hope you've enjoyed trotting along with us in the back catalogue of Glenda Jackson. Probably a lot of these films haven't been seen by our listenership, and I think you should really actually seek all of them out, including A Touch of Class.
Bum, bum. Okay, so Brian, our next episode is the last in this current series as we know it.
Yes, it will be the last of our Good, Bad, Crazy because the sun is out. Frankly, we've been spending too much time in the podcasting studio, too much time watching movies.
And I have to watch a couple of hundred short films.
Yes, actually, are we allowed to announce this news?
I mean, it's not really news, but you're allowed to talk about it.
It's exciting news. Sean has been given a prestigious position at the British Film Institute, which, of course, is where our national film is preserved.
It's a hotbed of socialism, as well we know.
What are you doing, darling?
I'm helping select some of the short films for the London Film Festival.
Very exciting. So yeah. Sean has a full plate of movies to watch. I also have to spend quite a bit of the summer doing what I do best, which is sitting in a library researching obscure things on my new writing fellowship. I'm sure we'll talk all about this more later if you're curious about our lives.
Yay!
I'm really glad you're doing a short film, darling, because as we know, you yourself are short and perfectly formed.
Oh, damn right I am.
But we have one really wonderful actress to bring you for our last Good, Bad, Crazy selection. We are going to defy the current trends of anti-Europeanism and go across the channel to spend three films surveying the career Le Bon, Le Mauvais et Le Fou de Juliette Binoche.
Yes, and they're all French titles.
That is true.
Yes.
Okay, so we will be teasing that trilogie de Juliette au notre page du Twitter, whatever that means.
Aujourd'hui.
Aujourd'hui, bon mot, hors d'oeuvre.
Maintenant.
At Broad Appeal Plot. At Broad Appeal Plod. We've really been plodding along. Yeah. No, it's at Broad Appeal Pod. Please, please follow us. You can find me at BA Mullen Speaks.
And I'm at Sean McGovern X.
Please rate and review us. We need your adulation. It feeds us. Otherwise, we'll just sit here singing A Touch of Class theme tune forever.
Okay, thanks for listening.
See you very soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.